Stars past and present have been paying their tribute to Bill Tarmey, who's died at the age of 71. Bill spent 30 years playing Jack Duckworth. Actor Nigel Pevaro, who was his on-screen son Terry, says he was a second father, while Julie Goodyear, who played barmaid Bette Lynch, described him as a wonderful man. Corrie's executive producer Kieran Roberts says the cast and crew are devastated.
I think it's a huge loss. The fact that Jack Duckworth was the enormous legend that he was, I think, has so much to do with Bill's brilliant talent, and we will all miss him very much.
330 jobs have been axed at the collapsed electricals chain Comet. The administrators already launched a liquidation sale this week at stores. Unison says NHS Direct is closing most of its call centres with the loss of hundreds of jobs. The union claims 24 of the 30 sites are shutting at the service. The Conservative peer Lord McAlpine's denied allegations linking him to claims of child abuse. He's released a statement describing allegations relating to a children's home in North Wales as wholly false and seriously defamatory. The next Archbishop of Canterbury says he wants women bishops in the church and has promised to engage with the gay community. Justin Welby's appointment has been confirmed after days of speculation. The current Bishop of Durham is taking over from Dr. Rowan Williams, who's stepping down next month. The former oil executive insists he won't just be picking up where his predecessor leaves off.
I'll do things differently. I have my own particular skills, which are not anything like his. The key areas for me are going to be about the growth of the church and social justice.
And Bridget Jones is making a comeback. Publisher Jonathan Cape has acquired the third novel by Helen Fielding about the hapless Londoner. The book explores a different phase of Bridget's life and will be published in 2013. That's the latest. I'm Matt Steele.
The One Love Something. Hello, Bristol. Welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and we have something of about turn today with our news review and investigative reports coming up before six. After six, though, Labour councillor for St George West, Ron Stone, will be here to discuss the Bristol General Hospital development and to discuss looking at the latest child abuse claims and big business avoiding tax. Next Thursday's elections and other news in part two. But before all that, we'll take a look at recent crises in the health service and ask, are a combination of cuts and privatisation responsible for any of the recent crises we've seen in the health service locally and nationally? Burma, India and Sri Lanka were all British colonies until granted independence after World War II. So how are they faring now? Ram Selvar is here to discuss. Also, did Hitler really die, as we were told, on the 30th of April 1945? Where did that story come from? And is there evidence to the contrary? And we review the world's news with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. First, though, our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows of 7 degrees Celsius and some showers tonight. This weekend, highs of 10 Celsius, some hazy sunshine on Saturday, sunnier on Sunday. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius, a fairly cloudy but relatively dry week with some sunshine. Next weekend, that's the 17th and 18th of November, highs of 10 Celsius and fairly sunny. A little bit less wet, it looks like, over the next couple of weeks. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce our guest for the first part, which is usually the second hour, but this is the first hour, investigative stuff. And I'd like to introduce Daphne Havercroft from Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group. Hi, Daphne.
Hello, Tony. Good evening.
First story we're going to look at, health-related today, is this. This is from the end of October, this story. Bristol Children's Hospital cuts the number of heart operations after a formal warning. Just to recap, Bristol Hospital, where concerns were raised after children died after heart surgeries, received a formal warning from health regulators. The Care Quality Commission found that staffing on Ward 32, Bristol Children's Hospital, was inadequate and felt this had a major impact on the care of wealth and welfare of patients. As previously the Post reported, parents of children who died at the hospital this year following planned heart surgery had raised concerns about care and staffing on Ward 32. 7-year-old Luke Jenkins died weeks after 4-year-old Sam Turner both had had cardiac operations at the hospital. Now, Daphne, any thoughts about the impact of this? How important is it?
Well, it's a difficult one because Bristol is one of seven specialist centres for paediatric cardiac surgery. They were chosen after a safe and sustainable review. And there are a number of other centres, for example, Leeds and Leicester, I think the Royal Brompton, who have raised concerns about their own hospitals not being chosen. So I think you would assume that if Bristol has been chosen, that it would be delivering care that is among the best in the country. And indeed, Bristol's paediatric cardiac mortality rates, they are among the best in the country based on information that is available. But I think the question is, was the quality of post-operative care considered in these comparisons? And I think one of the very troubling things about this particular situation is that bereaved parents were raising concerns about lack of staffing earlier this year. And it was only after they raised concerns that the Care Quality Commission went in and found in an unannounced visit that the staffing was inadequate. So you've got to ask two questions. Why was the Trust not staffing the Ward 32 where these children were being cared for sufficiently? And how come it takes parents going to the regulator for the regulator to wake up and realise what's going on?
And also, of course, for the Trust to admit that this is happening. I suppose this is why, one would hope that when this, if there is any kind of problem, that this is going to be picked up before children are dying. Now, we don't know for certain that the deaths of these children is directly related to those staffing levels, but certainly the Care Quality Commission are saying by intervening in this way that they think that there's a reasonable chance that it is. So, how are these staffing levels set, and why is it that it looks as if there just simply weren't enough staff around on these wards to care for these children? I think they're high dependency wards, aren't they?
Well, there was. It's a bit confusing because I think some parents have said that they were told that there were high dependency beds on that ward and there weren't. And I think it goes back to where's the corporate and clinical governance? And if you go back to the original BRI heart scandal, where the public inquiry reported in 2001, and what that said was that parents and any patients should be able to look at the standards that are being provided by that hospital, a particular hospital, and compare it with standards around the country to see that they're getting a good service. And what's really worrying about this is that I've seen a letter that was written to bereaved parents by Deborah Evans. Now, she's the chief executive of Bristol Primary Care Trust, and she chairs the Southwest Specialist Commissioning Group that commissions children's heart services at University Hospitals Bristol. And in this letter, she says that the Safe and Sustainable Review, which selected the Children's Hospital as one of these seven specialist centres, doesn't mean that the care of individual patients and their families is excellent, simply that the ingredients are there for a high quality service. But if you look at the CQC's report, the Care Quality Commission report, that suggests that the ingredients were not there because they said that the staffing levels were set in line with those found on a paediatric general ward, even though guidelines for the Royal College of Nursing require more registered nurses to provide high dependency care, one nurse to every two children. So what the Trust was doing was providing a lower ratio of nurse to patient care. So that doesn't say to me that was an ingredient for providing the care that those families should have expected. And the Care Quality Commission also said that it contacted the commissioners prior to its unannounced visit to Ward 32, and they raised no concerns about the service. So that says to me the commissioners don't know what's going on in the hospitals where they're commissioning services. So what are they being paid for?
Well, that's a good question. Definitely, don't you think that some of this may just simply be to do with the cash-strapped nation, that, you know, many of these public services, we're now being told we have to have cuts, etc., and that almost right across the board, it's almost inevitable that some of these frontline services are going to be affected by the cuts.
Yes, and they have to balance the books. But if you look at what's been happening in Bristol over the past 10, 11 years, go back to 2001, there was the Kennedy public inquiry into paediatric cardiac surgery. A year later, we had the collapse of Bristol's paediatric pathology department. 2008, the surgeon that they brought in after the original BRI heart scandal to turn around children's surgery left, saying that there were problems with staffing levels with technicians in operating theatres. 2009, local GP Dr. Phil Hammond blows the whistle on unsafe histopathology. So yes, the NHS has always been subject to cost constraints, but the recent things that have gone on with the finances and the big cuts to public services, that doesn't explain this catalogue of shortcomings going back to 2000 and back into the 90s.
Well, I notice also that Dr. Jacqueline Cornish, she was the head of Women's and Children's Services, probably I think still is even,
she is.
Bristol Children's Hospital, is also a merchant venturer. These merchant venturers actually frustrate me because they keep popping up everywhere. And now, since we've had this Care Quality Commission report really ticking off the Children's Hospital, she seems to have disappeared, or at least she's not certainly part of the publicity surrounding the hospital's response to it.
Well, no, that's an interesting one. You would think that the head of Women's and Children's Services would be there explaining how this had happened, but there's been no sign of her. And on the subject of merchant venturers, the Trust Board Chair, Dr. John Savage, is also a merchant venturer and has serious unanswered questions raised against him about what action he took when he was copied on a letter in 2008 from a consultant raising concerns about unsafe histopathology at his hospital.
Oh, right, yes. You've mentioned that before on here. But then, of course, you know, as a chief executive or a chairman, whoever is running these organisations, I mean, you can't literally react to every single letter that you get. But, I mean, certainly it should indicate that there may be a problem somewhere. Also, whilst we're on the health theme, not so much of a local theme, this week we've had, just trying to find my story here actually, we've had an NHS, the first NHS trust run entirely by a private firm, has racked up a £4 million debt in just 6 months. Martin, maybe I'll bring you in on this one. This is a firm originally predicted a £1.9 million deficit. The National Audit Office says lessons must be learned for future privatisation plans. The chair of the Public Accounts Committee, Margaret Hodge, is astonished at this company's Circles deficit. The UK's first privately run NHS hospital generated a deficit more than twice as high than planned, emerged during the week. The Circle is the company that's privatised Hinchinbrook Healthcare Trust in Cambridgeshire, and projected the trust would be £1.9 million in deficit after 6 months of its stewardship. But in September, it's got a deficit of £4.1 million. Now, this isn't the first time, Martin, is it, that we've discussed on here these privatised trusts, and in fact, even non-privatised trusts going into deficit. It seems that quite right across the country, in order to keep the health service going, that many trusts, private or otherwise, are racking up massive debts to try and keep things moving.
Well, I think the fundamental problem is the health service reforms in the past, never mind the health service reforms to come. If you think about a trust managing something like this, they are basically a law unto themselves to some extent. So, for example, the decision to have a smaller number of people on this ward is possibly essentially a financial decision to make sure that this is cheaper. And, of course, trusts are basically being run as businesses. Now, there's an illusion that businesses are always more efficiently run than the public sector, but you've got to draw a distinction between efficiency and effectiveness. Efficiency is doing things more cheaply. Effectiveness is when you actually make sure that whatever it is done, and then you count the money up afterwards. So when you're talking about people's lives, I mean, that's what we're talking about here, you want to be effective, not necessarily just efficient. And in the past, for example, if a hospital ran a deficit, it didn't necessarily matter because the hospital is basically a public institution, and if it's got more work to do, it just spends more money. Now, people think, oh, that's just writing a blank cheque to spend any money you like. No, it doesn't have to be like that. A properly planned national health system is in fact cheaper than a market free-for-all. For example, bulk buying of drugs, training, all of these things are overheads which a national system is much more efficient at and effective at dealing with than this kind of fragmented system. Now, both New Labour and current government have bought into the idea that the more semi-private sector negotiated contract type relationships you've got, the more efficient things will be. Now, in actual fact, there's more money being spent on admin in the National Health Service now than ever, because all of these deals that are being done are constant, that basically people are spending their time negotiating deals, whereas in the past they concentrated on clinical care and the money was secondary. Now, we've actually got to get back to that principle.
One of the things Margaret Hodge said in the Public Accounts Committee on this subject was that Circle struck a 10-year deal under which it can earn £31 million if it delivers unprecedented annual savings of more than 5%. So Circle gets a financial reward itself, even though it's running a deficit, so long as it delivers some savings from what originally were there. So it's a bit of a sort of twisted financial arrangement, isn't it? They can still make lots of money, even though the deficit in their trust is increasing.
Well, yes, and ultimately you got like Southern Cross in the care industry, which goes bust, and then who picks the tab up? Ah, central government. So central government basically gives these people the power to do what they want, and then of course if they mess it up, they walk away with whatever profits they've made, and then the public sector has to go in and clean the mess up. And in actual fact, this is a more expensive way to run things than having a proper plan. And that was the original conception of a national health service, is to have a plan. And I make no apologies for that. You can't run everything as a market. Some things have to be planned.
Okay, back to you then, Daphne Havercroft from South West Whistleblowers Health Action Group. Tell us a little bit about your organisation and why you think whistleblowing is so important.
Well, we were formed in September 2011, and it was because we're unhappy with the histopathology inquiry that I've spoken about on this show before, where doctors whistle blew about what they regarded as unsafe histopathology in the city. And histopathology is the analysis of tissue to find out if people have or have not got disease. So it was University Hospitals, Bristol NHS Foundation Trust, where the concerns have been raised against it. They ordered an inquiry into it, but there are a considerable number of what we regard as very serious irregularities in how it was conducted, and we formed our group because we were unhappy with that. But if you come back to the Ward 32, what's happened with the children this year, it's got the same root causes. All these things that have gone on in Bristol that I mentioned earlier have got the same root causes. And the question's got to be asked is, well, why has clinical and corporate governance failed? And why is nobody, none of the managers, none of the senior doctors involved, why, and the nurses as well, why are none of them being held account to explain why these failings have happened? Because every time they happen, we're told, oh, we've learned lessons, you know, we regret this, we apologise to people affected. But they don't learn the lessons, and nobody looks into why they don't.
Well, that's a pity. I mean, I certainly, you know, chatting to some old public relations friends of mine, they would say back in the 1960s and 70s, before the first big sort of rollout of privatisation, many of these public services, the senior figures, senior managers, would all be very much in the public domain. You know, they would be out there. As soon as there was any problem, they would be up there in public defending it. And nowadays, it seems sometimes they're just simply not, you know, very, you know, they're actually not quite so willing to go out to the public and explain why things are going wrong, and also, of course, if it's proved to be going wrong on their watch, to move aside and let someone else take over. Martin, isn't there something a little bit sort of wrong with the whole idea of private businesses in the health service? Because you've got two different kind of ways of doing things, haven't you? A private company is trying to do it as cheaply as possible for its shareholders, and so it can maximise the pay to its senior staff sometimes too, and also trying to hire people as cheap as possible. That's a big objective of private companies, possibly migrant workers if they can get them, wherever the type of people they're employing is much more sometimes many times short term and cheap labour. And also that there is a culture of secrecy that comes with private companies which doesn't really fit very well with public service.
Well, I would totally agree with that. I think what we've got to try and get people to understand that the market is fine, but the market is not the answer to every problem. It's we've got this idea that if all you've got in your hand is a hammer, then every problem looks like a nail. Now, the conception of having a national health service, which is unique to Britain, nobody else actually does it like this. But the OECD did a study some while ago which showed that the British National Health Service is the most efficient health service in the world. I mean, there's still problems with it, of course, but it's still more efficient than other setups in other countries. And the outcomes in places like France and Germany are better than in Britain, but then they spend a lot more than we do. Britain has actually got a very efficient service, believe it or not, but the marketisation of the service actually leads to inefficiencies. And of course, when people die and things go wrong, then that's really inefficient because you've actually failed completely at your fundamental task. But I think over time, people will realise, and we're going to have a swing of the pendulum back towards a more managed system. I mean, a lot of the time is wasted in the health service with negotiations about contracts and about the producer-provider split and all the rest of it. This, frankly, is a lot of nonsense, and we should not be doing any of it at all. But nobody's actually brave enough to say, actually, we've been doing the wrong things for 20 years, 30 years. Let's go back to the way we did it before. But eventually, I think the penny will drop.
Well, I have to correct you there, because some people are brave enough. One group is the Joint Chapels of the Health Service Unions. They are announcing a protest on Saturday the 1st of December, assembling at 11 o'clock at College Green and ending in a rally at Castle Park on at 12:30. That's Saturday the 1st of December. They're calling it Oppose the South West Pay Cartel. Now, this is also looking at health service workers' pay because there is an attempt to regionalise it. Martin, why is that?
Well, I mean, it's all part of the market philosophy, and the idea is that in poor parts of the country, you could perhaps get ancillary staff, for example, cheaper because people are more desperate and so on. But of course, paying the same rates across the national rates across Britain actually is a way of redistributing spending power from wealthier and more prosperous regions to regions which are less prosperous. So, you know, if people in Liverpool are being paid the same as in Bristol, that's actually a leg up for Liverpool, because that money then leaks into the local community. But of course, if you've got regional pay, that means eventually you're going to have a race to the bottom. And from a macroeconomic point of view, cutting pay and cutting benefits is exactly the wrong thing to do as you move into a banking crisis, which is what we're doing now. And so in actual fact, what we really need to do is actually reboot our public sector as a means of saving the society and the economy from collapse, and then we move on to really rebuilding things. I mean, but at the moment, the cuts policy is actually going to lead to regional and national stagnation
and possibly people dying too.
Oh yes.
If you look at the city from a sort of strategic point of view, we've got the two big health trusts. We've got North Bristol, which is Southmead Hospital and French A, and also the Central Bristol Trusts. Those are separate, but I mean, I do scratch my head when I look, Daphne, at what's going on in health in the city, because French A has got an international reputation, a fantastic reputation. A lot of that hospital has been also built through private subscription, that is to say, people have volunteered money, campaigns have been run to build parts of it. That now looks like that French A site is going to be flattened to make way for this new PPI up at Southmead Hospital, which is just in the process of opening at the moment. What are your thoughts about that? Why is it that the Bristol's French A, which has got such a fantastic reputation, I mean, this might be a bit of a big question to be putting to you right now, but I'm putting you on the spot, but why is it, and how we get to the situation where something so illogical seems to be the best way forward?
There's a lot of history, I think, to what's going on, and I'm probably not the expert on this, but there are people in the city and in South Gloucestershire who are. And it all goes back to what the NHS has been doing under the Bristol Health Services Plan that's now called the Healthy Futures Programme. And it's all been about integrating health services for the right reasons in principle. So if you've got services at French A, South Mead, the BRI, the same services, then why not look at bringing teams together in one place? So you've got that expertise in one place, you can make the service more efficient, etc., and you could perhaps make it more cost effective to deliver as well. But there's all sorts of things been going on with the Bristol Health Services Plan and the amount of money that's been available for that. And there's some questions being asked about how much, well, what money was set aside for certain things like French A, like the hospital at Thornbury, like the Clevedon Community Hospital. And suddenly people are being told, well, we haven't got the money to do this. So I think there's some serious questions need to be asked about, well, where's the money gone?
But I would also suggest that those two sites, French A and the Bristol Head General Hospital, which has been sold off already, are the two prime development sites, aren't they? For if you were a developer looking there saying, I would like to build some luxury flats, actually French A is gorgeous. I mean, it's a beautiful little village. Yeah. And also the Bristol General Hospital's on the water side as well. So possibly, Martin, do you think that might have been part of the decision-making process in deciding which to sell off and which to keep?
Well, I have no inside knowledge. The suspicion has got to be that what's happening is profiteering on the back of the health system. And in the PFI building of hospitals, for example, is more expensive than the government building hospitals. But of course, it doesn't appear on the government's books as government spending. Of course, it's government spending in the future, because of course these PFI deals lead to the hospital basically ending up being owned by the companies that built it with private money. And it was New Labour that brought all this in, so the Labour Party is to some extent disarmed in arguing against these things. But I think the time has come for people to realise that doing things with the private sector is A, more expensive, and B, leads to failure. And of course, in the 1940s and 1950s, everybody knew that. They knew very well that the government was not necessarily less efficient than the private sector that used to run the railways and the mines and so on and make a real mess of it. It was the Second World War which led to the creation of the National Health Service as a national institution. And in those days, politicians across the spectrum recognised the importance of having national institutions. We've lost that.
OK, Daphne, could you just remind us where we can find you online, and if someone would like to blow the whistle working within the health service, or else having some kind of relative who you feel that hasn't got what they wanted through the normal routes, how can people contact you?
If you just go into an internet search engine and put in Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group or SWWHAG, you will find us.
Thank you very much. And finally, opposing the Southwest pay cartel. This is the protest on Saturday, the 1st of December, at 11 o'clock at College Green, ending in a rally in Castle Park at 12:30. The statement from the joint union says the NHS that we know and love is under threat. One of the biggest challenges is the pressure to cut costs and make savings. This has resulted in 20 NHS trusts across the Southwest, including University Hospitals Bristol Trust and North Bristol Trust, to form the Southwest Pay Terms and Conditions Consortium, which is proposing radical changes to pay and conditions on the creation of a regional pay system. If they have their way, nationally agreed terms and conditions such as Agenda for Change will be swept away and replaced with local negotiations at trust level. Plans published by these employers propose changes which could cut pay, terms and conditions for nurses and other healthcare staff by up to 15%. Yet again, working people are being forced to bear the brunt of cuts to vital services. This will be bad for the NHS, bad for patients, and bad for all NHS staff across the UK. Local pay hurts the local economy, compromises patient safety, seriously damages staff morale, and creates instability in the workforce at a time when the NHS is going through unprecedented change. Please, they say, invite your friends and community groups. So that is a protest on Saturday the 1st of December, assembling at 11 o'clock at College Green and ending in a rally at Castle Park at 12:30.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, Burma, India and Sri Lanka were all British colonies until granted independence after World War II. So how are they faring now? Well, Ram Selvar is here with us to discuss it. Ram, first of all, with what is now coming out of Sri Lanka, are you yourself being from Sri Lanka?
Yeah, Sri Lanka has been in the news recently about all the deportations and then the high courts just ruling last minute that some people shouldn't be deported, and it's very confusing, the struggles.
Now, just let me recap, because a lot of people may have missed this in the news. This is British Sri Lankan people living in Britain who are being deported back to Sri Lanka with the possibility there of just being targeted by the regime. Tell us a little bit about the regime now running Sri Lanka. You know, who's in charge and what are they up to?
What went on and is slowly coming out through Channel 4 ran two documentaries called Killing Fields, Part 1, Part 2. There were different straplines. The serious killings had gone on in 2009, May, about 3 months leading up to that. Tens of thousands have perished when the government at that time maintained there were zero casualties, and the same regime is in charge. And it's actually trying to whitewash it using all sorts of anything that comes to their hand. They're making allegiances and connections with all the global conflicts with every side to escape accountability. So
I noticed that the president was over for the Queen's Diamond Jubilee celebrations and getting a nice lavish lunch at Buckingham Palace or wherever it was. I can't remember quite where, which is a little bit worrying. So, you know, what about the relationship between Britain and Sri Lanka? And I understand also that there's going to be a Commonwealth Games coming up there.
Well said. It's not the Commonwealth Games, it's a Commonwealth Heads of Government Summit.
Oh, it's okay, not the Games, the Summit.
It is a biennial. Every 2 years it happens, and it has emerged through lots of sources recently, especially WikiLeaks cables, the US cables, that the Commonwealth Summit was supposed to have been held in Sri Lanka in 2009, and then in 2011. It's definitely Gordon Brown stopped it from happening in 2011 to just because the whole matter was so covered up and they didn't want it to come to the fore, hoping the matter will be resolved. And that's the reason President of Sri Lanka, Mahinda Rajapaksa, was here for the Jubilee, and the because as head of the Commonwealth, the Queen has to go there next year to open it. So it's now postponed twice, and they're going to have it next year. And the government there is very keen to use anything and everything to cover up their crimes, and they want partners in crimes, and they want all the Commonwealth nations led by Britain to be part of it, of the cover-up. And
Martin, they've got a bit of a raw deal, Sri Lanka, haven't they, since independence?
Well, I mean, what we're talking about here, of course, is the overrunning of the Tamil-controlled areas in the north of the country, and massacres. The two films that Ram's talking about were on Channel 4, The Killing Fields of Sri Lanka. Basically, a massive massacre of innocent people caught up in the war.
I mean, the president at the time guaranteed safe areas, no fire areas, didn't he?
And then they attacked those areas essentially with mortars and bombs.
Yes, what they did is they said to the civilians, you know, we realise that this is really awful, you're getting caught up in this war, go to these safe areas. And then they started shelling, mortaring the safe areas and killing literally tens of thousands of civilians.
This is all very sharp, as Ram says, because of the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. The Sri Lankan government needs respectability. It needs
credibility.
So having the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting there with the Queen and David Cameron and all the rest of it, this all gives credibility to the existing government of Sri Lanka.
But if I was the Queen, which I'm not, but if I was, I'd be saying, well, isn't it great? We've put down the Tamil Tiger Rebellion.
Well, that's they won't openly say that, but I mean that is what the Sri Lankan government is hoping the conclusion will be, that they are, you know, they're on the side on the war on terror, etc., etc., etc. But of course, terrible things have gone on in Sri Lanka, and I think it's we're dealing with this kind of historical legacy of British imperialism all the time, and it's not just in Sri Lanka. I mean, we just saw the Kenyans who've been given leave to bring their case about torture and abuse by British forces in Kenya in the 1950s, including sort of castrations, electrocutions and mass murder. We're talking hundreds of thousands of people killed in camps run by the British government.
Well, we did a programme with Jim White, who lives in Bristol, about that, who was there.
You know, Britain has got a lot of relationships with all sorts of regimes around the world because of the history. And it's not a one-sided history. Britain's not a particularly evil country, but it's no better than it ought to be.
Okay, what would you say to that if the Queen were to say to you, Ram, well, you know, we've put down the Tamil Tiger Rebellion, which was causing so much trouble for something like 15 years?
It's sort of, you know, the problem is continuing. That is the key here, you know. The problem is, like, there's a lot of repression going on, and the Tamil Tiger being put down or not hasn't really sorted the problem. You know, the whole repression of another nation there, you know, I have come to sort of realize over time what's really going on with my people and my situation is there's a definitely different nation, and the lands have been occupied, and there's serious land grabbing going on, and a lot of the land is coming up as crown land. It's constantly mentioned how the land's changing hands, and the military is using a lot of paperwork. The Sri Lankan military is using the paperwork, claiming this was crown land, and you know,
so well, from the Queen, from the past.
Yes, of course. In Trincomalee, the Trincomalee tank farm recently came up. They had promised it to India at the heat of the battle. Now they wanted to take it away from the Indian companies. They had basically land grab from Tamil people living there through serious massacres and murders going as way back as 2006. There's a famous case of 17 aid workers got massacred belonging to the French NGO Action Against Hunger, and it's just the case has been reopened at the UN Human Rights Council. It's a 2006 story. That particular massacre was related to the Trincomalee Bay, which was the British headquarters during the Second World War in Asia, where Lord Mountbatten was based, and there are massive tank farms there. Those tank farms were promised to Indian companies, and then recently they backtracked on it. The government of Sri Lanka used an excuse saying this was crown land and it was not, the contracts were not
now,
drafted.
You know what, I'm remembering having Kevin Cahill in the studio here when he was talking about his book Who Owns the World, saying that actually a lot of land which was given back, so-called, to people when they got their independence around the world, like in India and other places, Australia even, is still actually owned by the Crown. Martin, this is pretty incredible, isn't it, that you can give back some political control but you're still going to own the land. This is unbelievable.
Well, but large tracts of land in Britain are owned by the Crown, which people don't realise.
But we haven't got our independence from Britain, have we? I mean, we are Britain, so what I'm saying is,
we're Scottish or Irish.
What I'm saying is, I think this is a little bit cheeky of Britain to give countries independence and then to hang on to the land.
Well, yes. I mean, in Ireland, the land has been invested in the state, but this is to do with land law. Yeah, don't forget that all land in 1066 belonged to William the Conqueror, and it's only gradually been, you know, allowed out to other organisations. And in any case, all property rights are basically rights to use something. They're relationships rather than things.
And it's probably true to say that much of the land from William the Conqueror hasn't been, you know, it's still in the same hands.
Well, Kevin Cahill's book about Britain pointed out that, you know, who owns Britain? Well, it's the same people who owned it then. I mean, the Duke of Westminster and the aristocracy and the Crown still own a large chunk of Britain's land.
Okay, Ram, you know, someone is a Tamil yourself and an expert on the region. Can you see any solutions, actually, in Sri Lanka particularly?
It has to come from the people, the Tamil people, the Sinhalese people, neighbouring Indian people, to be aware of what's really going on, you know. Just a lot of people are sort of, that's where the news, the information flow is, even amongst the Tamil diaspora, which is in the West with so much information channels, they don't know what's going on, because it's becoming a forgotten war, always tarred with the talk of the Tigers or the LTTE, you know, as if it's something to do with, started with them and finished with
them.
Do
you think a bit of one of these divide and rule situations? Diane Abbott was talking about that. She was ticked off for it on Twitter on another topic. But, I mean, there does seem to be quite a lot of this, maybe actually almost encouraging factional infighting and sectarianism in order to sort of keep people at each other's throats rather than, you know, doing something to change the system.
Yeah, the ethnic rivalries in that region has been played for a long time, and it's a geostrategically important, the most important shipping lanes, people say, you know, and we can just see scarily it's all coming you know, the people who can have the, who have big businesses, they're just having their way, basically. You know, they're actually having the Commonwealth Summit next year, and what the Queen might say or not, as you ask, it's not the question there, really. It's just what the people there don't know what's going on. If you're in the island, it's nice and sunny for tourists to go there. They take
it tourists still going to Sri Lanka, even after all these massacres?
The Lonely Planet recently voted Sri Lanka as the top destination and for tourists.
Lonely Planet, right, yeah, crikey.
Yeah.
Okay,
lots of marketing going on.
Okay, just finally, can you just sum up what you think would be an actual good solution there? I mean, is it just simply a question of getting rid of your present president in Sri Lanka and replacing him with whom?
Freedom of speech is the most important thing. It's always been the biggest casualty there. Recently, the Sunday Leader, this newspaper whose editor famously wrote his own obituary and he got assassinated in 2009, you know, that same newspaper, the editor who replaced him fled last 2-3 days ago, fled Sri Lanka. So it's just showing that the repression of media is very sad. And we just have to get informed. That's where the solution is, you know.
Okay, and as someone who's pretty well informed yourself, can you just tell us about this recent hunger strike and whereabouts people can find out about the latest online about what's going on in Sri Lanka?
Oh, yeah, that's to do with... there's a big hunger strike going on in Nauru, a Polynesian island. It's possibly a protectorate of India... protectorate of Australia... And it's a Commonwealth nation. The Commonwealth Secretary General was there at the end of October. But there's a Persian guy on hunger strike there for 25th day as of very recently, 2 days ago, when it was reported on a Facebook page that they can't report anymore. They don't have internet access. There are about 300 people on 7th or 8th day of hunger strike as of last 2 days ago. You know, and there's a whole mixture of people who are refugees who are plying the Indian Oceans. There's Afghanis, Persians, Tamils from Sri Lanka, other communities from Sri Lanka, Burmese people. They're all being locked up. Soon after the 9/11, the Australian government and the Indonesian government started a process called the Bali Process, aided by the International Organization of Migrants, and that was called the Pacific Solution by the Howard government. They started incarcerating refugees in the Pacific, in Nauru, a very small island, and even a smaller island called Manus, it's almost like militarized camps. And in the past, the Australian Marines had to go in there and attack people who were on hunger strike, and then the Australian Labor government in 2008 stopped the practice. The Kevin Rudd's government stopped it, but the current government, because of the inflows of refugees in the Indian Ocean and who are applying to Australia, with UN Human Rights Council condemning Australia, have started to put people back. They reopened the camps. The International Organization of Migrants have reopened the camps in Nauru. And there are 300 people on hunger strike, and the Commonwealth Secretary General was there end of October. Prince William and the camps were opened in August. Prince William and Duke and Duchess of Cambridge were there in that region. They didn't go to Nauru, but they were in the region. You know, it's not. It's sad that news like that doesn't come forward.
So, where is a good place online to find out about the latest from that region?
Australian newspapers, the Green Left is like an Australian sort of a political concept in Australia. They have been covering this a little bit, but it's all very much connected to our sort of Commonwealth heritage. So,
Martin, this seems to be a bit of a pattern we have on here from time to time. Is this whole business of really still Britain being actually quite powerful? I mean, the Commonwealth and the heads of the Commonwealth can do quite a lot, couldn't they, to help freedom of speech in these places and also to tick off people who are abusing human rights, but they don't seem to do it.
Well, yes, I mean, it's a site of struggle. I mean, the Commonwealth is a part of all of our heritage here in Britain and elsewhere in the world, and we should be concerned about ex-British colonies where human rights are being abused.
Of course, we had a very good Commonwealth Museum at Temple Meads up until a couple of years ago. They did a very good exhibition on the 200th anniversary of the abolition of slavery, and then they got their funding pulled. So that wasn't particularly wonderful. But I mean, you know, that was they also said they might be moving to London. We've heard recently that they won't actually. All the everything that was the Commonwealth Museum, Empire and Commonwealth Museum, is being gifted to the British Museum, and the Empire and Commonwealth Museum is no more. Now, I think that's a great pity, because what they were doing is they were showing it warts and all. They really were. Mm-hmm. And that exhibition that we had a couple of years ago, 2008, actually, wasn't it, on the 200th anniversary, was one of the best exhibitions I've ever been to. Really, really in your face.
Well, I think that's very important for everybody, whatever their position on the political spectrum. Britain's history is what this is all about, and it's a mixed story. We've got our finest hour defeating Nazi Germany, and we've got some other less fine hours, like when we tortured hundreds of thousands of Kenyans to death in the 1950s, not the 1850s. I think that what's fantastic about Britain's cultural influence is that everybody speaks our language, and if you've got open ears, we've got a fantastic information flow here, particularly in international cities like Bristol. There's no excuse for ignorance if you're British.
Okay, Ram, final word with you. Any other websites you'd like to just flag up as good sources of info for Sri Lanka and surrounding region?
Unfortunately, as I said, the Tamil community isn't really up to speed with this fast-moving stuff going on. I would say tamilsolidarity.org is somebody who's addressing some of the issues. And if I may say so, one thing is, within the Commonwealth, the business is what Tony Blair, I think it was in 2007, the Commonwealth Heads of Government Summit in Edinburgh, he started a mechanism called the Commonwealth Business Council. As you say, lots of cultural ties are being cut, but that's on the rise. It's run by Indian technocrats and business interests. Coming from India, who should be a voice for all the South Asian conflicts, we can see there's only the business, as business and the nastiest business elements have sort of reared their, you know, most ugliest form, and they are running the Commonwealth. That's what it's all coming down to.
Yes, well, of course, we've also got we've seen David Cameron in the Middle East this week calling for an armed rebellion in Syria, whilst he sells aircraft to the Saudi Arabians, who are repressing their own people and the people of Bahrain. I mean, it couldn't be clearer what the hypocrisy is, could it?
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Right, Martin, we've had two big elections of two massive sort of global power blocks this week. We've had the US, and I must admit I was relieved in the morning during the week to hear that Obama was re-elected. I'm rather scared of thinking of Mitt Romney with his finger on the nuclear button. And also in China, one of these massive congresses, which is almost completely sealed off and rather robotic-looking.
Yeah, I mean, as a presenter, Tony, you should show some, what's the word, less bias about things. I mean, let's face it, I mean, you know. But Romney, I'm glad Romney wasn't elected as well. But on the other hand, Obama is still very much in the pocket of the vested interests. What's happened in China is more opaque. Essentially, what's happening at the Chinese Communist Party Congress is things that have been decided behind closed doors are being rubber-stamped by the delegates.
But it's not a communist country, really, is it? Isn't it just a bunch of plutocrats now?
No. They've still got aspects of the way they're running their economy which the Western powers are not happy with. So, for example, they've still got a largely state-run banking system which has not got involved in some of the more obscure games of the City of London. I think the Chinese now are dependent upon exports to the rest of the world, so they're actually part of the capitalist system, but the way they run their system is not quite the same as what you'd find in India, for example. So the danger is that as we move into a kind of economic meltdown, slowdown, is that political conflicts will simply explode. And we've got a face-off, for example, between the Japanese and the Chinese and the Filipinos about islands in the South China Sea, as the Chinese call it. We've got a potential war in the Gulf with the British and the US deploying aircraft carriers and submarines and so on. And the euro, they had the Greek vote this week on the euro, that could lead to a collapse of the euro. The situation is incredibly fragile.
Can you address this business of the robotic Chinese? Because who's actually running that country?
Ultimately, it's very hard to say. It's like saying who was running the Kremlin in years gone by. What happens every decade? They have a change of the guard in China, where a whole new generation of leaders come forward, most of whom we've never heard of, because of course politics in China isn't run in the same way as it is in the US or in Britain. But nevertheless, of course, they are big players on the international stage. China itself has got economic problems. I mean, they've got a property bubble in Shanghai, which is just as bad as anything in the West. They could have a crash, and of course, that could lead to a revolution in China.
And what about
could lead to a revolution in the US?
And what about Greece this week? I mean, to get a little bit closer to home with Angela Merkel also coming over to London, bizarrely. Well, David Cameron couldn't make it to Question Time. He was able to meet Angela Merkel the same day to talk about the euro, and apparently about the euro, maybe other things too.
Yes, well. David Cameron would love the Germans to bail out the Greeks, but he's got no money to put into it. He wants money. The British approach to EU policy is essentially not to get involved.
But I mean, she's saying
to shout from the sideline.
She's saying, begging him really to stay in the EU. Is there really any prospect of Britain leaving the EU?
Well, you better ask David Cameron's allies on the right wing of his party. They're quite keen on leaving the EU. I mean, basically, to be honest, many people in the EU would be quite happy to see a Conservative-led Britain leave the EU. But, of course, that does mean that we would have tariff barriers against our exports to France. That's what leaving the EU means. You basically lose your most favoured nation status.
And is there any prospect of some of the most normal, sensible things happening, like, for example, stopping tax havens, impounding money that's in tax havens, taxing that money?
The EU, in principle, ought to be big enough to stand up to the banks and to stand up to the multinational companies. In practice, they're too weak, and the vested interests are too strong. And that is why, probably, it's too late now. I'm afraid the banks are bust, there's going to be a crash, and once that's happened, then we will talk about what kind of society we want and how we're going to get it.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, did Adolf Hitler really die, as we were told, on the 30th of April 1945? Where did that story come from, and is there any evidence to the contrary? Well, one person that thinks there is Peter Levender. He's written a book called Ratlines: Soviet Spies, Nazi Priests and the Disappearance of Adolf Hitler. This is really unbelievable, I suppose, many people would think, that we don't know actually what happened. So here's Peter Levender talking about on the Coast to Coast programme, talking about how he first started to question whether Hitler really died, as we were told, at the end of the war in the Hitler bunker in 1945.
I was invested in the idea that Hitler committed suicide on April 30th, 1945. I wrote about it in Unholy Alliance. I wrote about the significance of that day for German paganism, for instance. So I had never questioned the idea that Hitler died in the bunker on that day, committing suicide, shot himself through the head, and took the cyanide capsule simultaneously. This was something I took for granted, and I think most people do. So when I heard a rumor this might not have been the case, I went back and I researched considerably what really took place at that time. What was the story? And the story we've been told is the cover story written by a man called Hugh Trevor Roper, very famous British historian, who at that time was a major in the MI6, in the Secret Intelligence Service, British Intelligence, during World War II. And he was tasked with this idea. He was tasked by his commanding officer, Dick White, who said, "You've got to go out and prove that Hitler committed suicide in the bunker. You've got 3 months to do this. We know you don't speak German. Doesn't matter. Go out and prove that he died, because the Russians are saying we're protecting him, that we managed to allow him to escape. So you have 3 months. Prove that he died." In other words, begin from a conclusion and work your way backwards.
Right.
So this is the story we've been told, the famous story of the bunker. There's a handful of Nazis still left. The bombs are falling. The Russians are coming into Berlin. It's only a matter of hours before the entire city is under Russian occupation. Hitler sees the time has come. The end is near. It's Gitterdammerung. He marries Eva Braun, his longtime mistress, the day before. They have a brief wedding ceremony. And then the next day, April 30th, around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Eva Braun takes a cyanide capsule. Hitler chews on a cyanide capsule and simultaneously shoots himself in the head. The shot is heard. or the smoke from the pistol is smelled, depends on who you talk to. They break open the door, and there's Hitler and Eva Braun dead on a sofa. That's the story we've been told. And then we've been told that the body of Hitler and the body of Eva Braun were brought upstairs to the open air in front of the bunker, to a kind of garden area, and were cremated. And the bodies left in a kind of crater. And depending upon who you talk to, this story changes considerably. All of the SS officers who were involved in this tell a different story. Some were in captivity by the Soviets. They told the Soviets one story. Those in captivity by the British told the British a different story, told Trevor Roper a different story. In fact, told Trevor Roper several different stories. He sort of cherry-picked the one he liked best. The Soviets were doing the same thing on their side. The Americans, to a certain extent, on their side. So suddenly, as I'm looking at all of this, I'm realizing that the eyewitness testimony doesn't match. It's all contradictory. Everybody's telling a different story. Even the SS under Soviet control, who were being tortured for their stories, were telling the Soviets different stories.
That was Peter Lavender there. Peter is author of Ratlines, Soviet Spies, Nazi Priests and the Disappearance of Adolf Hitler. Now, Martin, is there any credibility to this? Because the guy he's talking about there, who wrote the original story about what happened to Adolf Hitler, Hugh Trevor Roper, who worked for MI6, has died recently.
Well, I mean, these kind of things have got to be looked into in detail. One can assert that Hitler did die or assert that he didn't die, and it's actually a factual matter that needs to be ascertained. I mean, what the author has uncovered there is that there's contradictory testimony from different people.
Well, one of the things that got me particularly interested in this was an article in last year in the Daily Mail saying that that scientists had had a look at what was supposed to be Hitler's skull being kept by the Russians over in Russia, and they said actually this is the skull of a woman. So these are the sort of basic assumptions that you would make that are now being questioned all this time afterwards.
Well, even more interesting and more to the point to my mind is that it's absolutely clear that large numbers of senior Nazis, A, were allowed to escape, and B, many of them were recruited into the Western Intelligence Services. So Reinhard Gehlen, G-E-H-L-E-N, Reinhard Gehlen was the head of the Gestapo's operation in Eastern Europe, and he just basically approached the Americans and the British at the end of the war and said, do you want my networks in Eastern Europe? And they said, yes, we do, because the communists are now our enemies. And he became the head of the West German Secret Service. Now, there's no secret about that. So the former head of the Gestapo becomes the head of the West German Secret Service. What sort of message does that send to Moscow?
Well, also, Peter Lavender goes on to talk about a Fourth Reich, something surviving after the end of the Third Reich at the end of World War II.
There was definitely a Fourth Reich, as far as I'm concerned, because the Nazi networks existed for long after the war and continue to exist to this day. So, and they're not existing in the sense that it's just a bunch of guys meeting for coffee once in a while. I mean, they're involved in drug smuggling, human trafficking, political assassinations. Those records are there. Klaus Barbie ran the Secret Service for Bolivia for a long time. I mean, these people were very much involved in Operation Condor, assassinating communist leaders throughout Latin America and in Europe. So there's definitely a history of Fourth Reich activity.
Well, what Peter Lavender's saying is that he believes that Hitler was taken off to Indonesia because he was too much of a hot potato to take to South America. Certainly lots of Nazis survived in South America, people who were supposed to be condemned at Nuremberg. But that was one of the things. And anyway, just to finally wrap up, the title of that book is Ratlines, Soviet Spies, Nazi Priests and the Disappearance of Adolf Hitler. And the author is Peter Lavender. After the news, our news review. We're back to front this week, the other way around with Ron Stone.
This is BCFM 93.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, the stars of Coronation Street have been reacting to the death of one of the